pretty great, right? All right, the next thing we're going to do is the panelists are going to ask each other questions. And the way the format of this is going to go, I think you all will ask questions first. Each panelist to my right will have 30 seconds to ask a question of the panelists to my left, who will then have either 2 minutes each or a total of 8 minutes for their whole side of the table to respond to those questions, and then we'll switch it up. After that, we'll go to Q&A from you all. So, you guys ready?
You got it? Okay. Great. So I guess question number one, it was stated just recently that violence of the system, the system only uses violence in sort of rare cases and with detriment to the system itself. And I wonder if that was in reference to what's happening now if you just walk the streets of East Oakland or Ghost Town, or are you talking about white bodies on cameras being brutalized by police?
Yeah, we're gonna ask all the questions and then get all the answers.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Okay. It was mentioned that that when we have these discussions, when we start talking about nonviolent strategy versus diversity of tactics, that suddenly we stop talking about strategy altogether. I may be paraphrasing, so forgive me. I'm wondering if there are specific examples of this happening, and in particular, if this has happened, if people have actually stopped talking about this, how has this affected movements that anybody on this panel has been a part of?
My only question would be directed towards Phil, who mentioned that a woman with a husband who is, I forget the words you used, but I understood you talking about a situation of abuse and saying that somebody should free themselves of that violence. But my question is, how do you free yourself of oppressive violence or abusive violence without using oftentimes force or violence against that to free yourself? So how do you respond to defensive violence, such as, you know, the violence of a queer person against a homophobic attack or a woman against her abusive husband? And how would you respond to people defending themselves against the police and other oppressive forces?
Hello. All right, cool. My question is really to try and enforce out some solid examples historically of times where exclusively nonviolent approaches within movements have brought us radical structural changes. Because the ones that I hear brought up a lot, for example, Gandhi or the civil rights movement, as Professor Shingavi recently said, he's an English professor at University of Texas, described how the final years of the Indian independence movement actually didn't involve Gandhi very much and involved a huge diversity of tactics. And we've learned the civil rights movement also had a number of different diverse approaches. So I want some specific examples.
Okay, so you have collectively among yourself 8 minutes. Do you know if you're going to just each speak for 2 minutes? Yeah? All right, so whoever wants to start.
Okay, so for the question where the strategy stops once we start talking about all this, I'd like to say that, you know, this time that's being spent this evening is not being spent reaching out to the general public. It's not reaching out to folks who are less inclined to be here. We could be, you know, like, if we're really, like, go get them, you know, and we could be hitting door to door, you know, talking to people. It's very difficult. It's a lot more difficult to speak with somebody and try to understand their perspective and why they do or don't support your movement, rather than just, you know, shrug your shoulders and say, oh, you know, well, whatever, if they don't want to be here, that's their thing. You know, if we are really genuine about our desire to grow this movement, we need to reach out to these people, you know, the people who work, you know, 12 hours a day. We need to reach out. If we're trying to be a movement of the 99%, I am actually a proponent of, I don't think our arguments, the overarching arguments for Occupy are that much different than Tea Party. You know, different angles, much different ideologies, But I'm saying, check your ideology at the door, be the bigger person, and get out there and talk to these people. We could sit here talking amongst ourselves, like I said, preaching to the choir for days and days, but that's not growing our movement.
Let me try to respond. I grew up at a time, the late 40s and 50s, when every week 100 to 300 black men were lynched every week simply because they were black. I grew up where if you went downtown Nashville, Tennessee, there'd be a sign on one door saying white and a sign saying colored. There were structural segregation. Structural segregation was eliminated in the United States by basically people who took it upon themselves to take the pain and suffering of others so they could bring about structural change. Radical structural change across this nation has taken place. We created the Council of Elders, or in the process of creating them, because with the understanding that during the 20th century, in the United States, we, the people of the United States, made the major advances in human freedom than ever before in human history during the 20th century. But the tragedy is that many of us have not read that history and learned it, so we cannot use the lessons of it for the 21st century. Now, I was in Selma. I know something about Selma. So I've heard distortions about what happened in the 20th century. And those distortions are only a part of us because we have not taken the time to learn to read the books and to learn what happened in the 20th century when women got the right to vote, when segregation was done away with, when child labor laws prevented children from working, when the greatest advancements are made. How can those greatest great advancements, the learnings, the lessons, become a part of the 21st century if we ourselves don't dwell into the research and the learning and understanding where we come from?
I'll see if I can speak quickly to two of those questions. One, sort of how do you free yourself from an abusive relationship without violence? You free yourself, first of all, by knowing that there's an option, that there's something else. Secondly, you free yourself by having support. That's why women organize things like women's shelters and women's clinics and women intervention clinics, things so that women could get out of abusive relationships. And in fact, you very rarely free yourself from an abusive relationship by violence. You often end up in a much worse situation. So, for me, part of nonviolence is organizing those structures of support and organizing those things like Oakland, Occupy Oakland, when it was thriving, that show another option to people and let people know there are possibilities they didn't believe there were before. In terms of the question of stopping talking about strategy, that's what I saw happen. For example, in Seattle in 1999, when we shut down the WTO, that was organized on a framework of strategic nonviolence. It had agreements. That's why 60,000 people came to Seattle. I went there with a whole cluster of people I'd done actions with for many years. most of whom would not have gone if they thought they were going to something where people were going to be breaking windows and lighting barricades on fire. Fast forward a few years to Miami, which was still a very successful mobilization, but when you walked into our convergence space in Miami, you were greeted by a guy sitting there in a black mask who looked at you and said, "Are you a cop or a journalist?" And you kind of went, "Do I have to be one or the other?" You know, "I'll be a journalist, okay." It was not exactly user-friendly. And that's kind of what continued to happen. I could say more, but I want to leave some time. But I could give you many, many, many examples of that. It made it really hard to continue to do outreach when we were organizing in that diversity of tactics frame.
So regarding how diversity of tactics stops strategy, conversations around strategy, I've been at general assemblies as well as meetings where people have been saying that we think that, you know, busting up the Whole Foods window was not strategic. And the argument is always, well, we've agreed on a diversity of tactics, period, end of story. So it doesn't allow for deeper dialogues and deeper analysis of what's actually right for this movement or not. Regarding violence and movements and what, you know, nonviolent movement has made changes, first of all, the civil rights movement, were there violent people in the movement? Yeah, I'm sure there were. Was there violence in that era? I'm sure there was. But the movement itself was nonviolent. And again, there might have been a march where someone broke a window. That does not make the movement nonviolent. And to say anything other than the civil rights movement created massive change, right, would be an understatement. And I would also argue, you know, where has violent movements brought about the changes that we want? Because for me, there's been revolutions, of course. There is not a single country in this world that has true justice, the type of society we want to create. And so I would argue that we need something that's never happened before, which is the whole world to commit to nonviolence. So.
Okay, thank you. Now, the folks to my left each have 30 seconds to ask a question of the folks on my right.
So my question is, for those who view the police as the enemy, or at least part of the enemy, what is your end goal? What would victory over the police look like? Does that mean we would lock them all up? Does that mean we would deport them all? Does that mean we would execute them all? When individuals become your enemy as opposed to the behaviors of those individuals and the injustice that they participate in, what does victory over them look like?
Okay, so my question is, what if the Occupy movement moves forward and the house of cards starts crumbling, the structure, what's to prevent when we fail to reach out to our counterparts in the center and the right? What's to prevent a civil war from breaking out rather than a revolution?
And I guess my question would be, if we advocate, well, I guess, you know, I could possibly be convinced that an armed revolution might be worth doing, might even be the only way to go, but I keep running up against the immense amount of violence and weaponry that the other side has. So how do you imagine in that situation we could actually win?
Rahula?
Yeah.
Can we ask for clarification from that last question? I'm not quite sure I heard what that question was.
I'm sorry, I'm just not sure I heard what that question was. If you could repeat or maybe clarify.
Yeah, I'm not very coherent tonight. I'm tired. But it's sort of like, it goes like, if you're doing self-defense against the police by actually fighting with them, and they have such overwhelming amount of force, weapons, and everything else at their disposal, how can we possibly win with that tactic?
All right, so you all have either, going to pass. So you have 8 minutes collectively or 2 minutes each to address the questions you've just been asked.
Anybody want to roll? Okay. I'll do it. Okay. So on the question of armed revolution, I actually don't think anybody is actually proposing I've never heard a proposal for armed revolution in any of the General Assemblies. Right? I think to actually answer your question, it's called asymmetrical warfare. And examples of that in history would be Vietnam, the Vietnamese against the French and then the Americans. They won eventually, not through a peace movement in the United States, but they were defeated militarily and politically. Get that straight. Another could be Iraq, which defeated the United States using asymmetrical warfare. And this is coming from someone who lost a lot of friends to people using asymmetrical warfare. We could look at Afghanistan, defeated both the USSR and the United States. So in terms of armed revolution, overwhelming superior force, if you're committed, you'll win. Second, the question about civil war, it's a very good question. I actually don't think there's any structure in place to stop it from devolving into civil war. And so there you go on that. Question of police as enemy, I actually find the binary slightly difficult to swallow. Not every police officer is this like part pig, part robot monster. Some are, but you know, the institution of the police, enemy. Their mentality, enemy. How they get to be above the law, enemy. Now, if tomorrow all the police were to suddenly disappear and there was chaos on the streets, people taking advantage, yeah, there would be some problems. But I also believe that collectively, us, we as people, have the right to use violence sometimes to protect ourselves. And I do not believe that structure is the same as hierarchy. And we can structure ourselves in a way to provide community defense. And I guess that's where I'll stop there.
Well, in a certain sense, you've posed us three impossible questions, which are all kind of the same question. But rather, I guess to start with the police question, I would say that the policing is a social relationship, and the institution of the police, like Matt said, is what needs to be abolished, not the individual police or those humans. It's not about going out and killing police exactly so much as it is abolishing that relationship, the laws that uphold this unjust system, et cetera, et cetera. And about the Civil War question, it's a good question, and I think that it kind of assumes that we're not already living under certain conditions of war and civil war, indeed, that are just controlled by the state, where we have people, you know, at battle against each other. We have armed gangs of, you know, people in inner cities who have joined together to defend themselves. Like, you can think about the Crips, which actually started as an anti-gang group and then became similar to other gangs in this process. But we can think of the police as their own gang, as, you know, a gang with badges, with legal backing, with heavy financial backing. We can think of the military as a giant conscripted gang under hierarchical organization ordered around by the US government. And that is not to, I'm not at all trying to, you know, take a stab at individuals who have participated in that, because we live under these coercive relationships. And also, I think it's interesting to point out that the police didn't exist in many cities as the institution that they are now until the development of industrial capitalism, basically. And you can see the commodity form and the industrial developments coming hand in hand with a police force who were there to defend the wealth that was being accumulated. And like in, I believe, London and New York both didn't have police forces until the mid-1800s. So you have to think of it as going hand in hand with the other social relationships and institutions that we are oppressed by. That's all.
I wanted to, I guess, Actually, I would have said exactly what Paolo said at the outset, that all of those questions seem to me as one as well. And although I definitely acknowledge that a lot of thought has gone into them, I'm wondering about our tendency to immediately, and I guess this will be my answer, sorry. I think that we have a tendency to immediately construct the most catastrophic image once we think of, when we hear the word revolution, when we hear the words, even when we hear the words radical, right? Like the most insane image comes to mind of like, you know, mobs of angry, like tall, or maybe like tall, very lithe Aryan men running down the streets with Molotov cocktails and like, you know, punching women and children in the face and like running down your grandma. I mean, this is real. Like this is what this question is. Like the question about a civil war is not of what prevents a civil war is not addressing the current state, the actual class war that we exist in right now. It doesn't acknowledge that we are actually at war, right? So what I would say is that I think it's important for us to stray away from the catastrophic image and to really, you know, like kind of turn off the television and look to your left and look to your right and see the damage that this class war has done to all of us. Probably more people outside than inside this room. And what would victory over the police look like? I think that an initial victory, I'm not claiming to have, you know, future seeing powers. An initial victory would be to get the police to stop protecting the property of the 1%, to get the police to actually acknowledge that either they believe in protecting civil society or they believe in protecting the status quo, which is capitalism, which is business as usual for everybody who is a billionaire or a millionaire, and everybody else can just suck it up. And how do we win against police violence? Again, I don't believe in absolutes, so I don't think that it's possible to have here's our strategy for winning against police violence. Like, we don't win against guns. We barely win against rubber bullets. That's absolutely right. But you know what? They use them against us anyways. So how do we win? We actually just have to come up with, we have to come up with better shields, and we have to come up with better strategies, period. Sorry.
I'll just repeat that I've never advocated for the option of everybody who believes in radical social change picking up arms and having a guerrilla warfare. I don't think that's the point that any of us were making. Also, in terms of reaching out to the masses in a more populist movement, I think there's a false dichotomy that nonviolent approaches welcome voices and diversity of tactics squashes voices. I think both have been very guilty of pushing out different kinds of people, and to create this false dichotomy that one is welcoming and one is not is false. The last thing I'll say is that I do feel like we're at a bit of a disadvantage only because nonviolent ways of life do sound great because we all want them. Every reasonable person here wants to live nonviolently, but the reality is not that beautiful, okay? And when you talk about women and children and families dying, that's happening already. It's not something that's going to happen if we are violent. It's happening right now. And I have yet to hear any example historically of a movement that has accomplished those type of changes with exclusively nonviolent methods. I still have yet to hear an example of that. So that's still my challenge.
Thank you all for your questions and your responses. So I want to just ask if you heard something tonight that challenged you to wave your arm around. If you heard something tonight that made your heart race, wave your arm around. If you heard something tonight that said a thing that you felt but never knew how to say before, like give a shout.